From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks your business is really, really all right life. He doesn't claim.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, how the founding of Facebook, a story of geeky guys writing computer code, came to be an Oscar-nominated hit movie. We talk with producer Dana Brunetti, who saw the potential in the behind-the-screen drama. But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Hollywood.
Joining me is my banter buddy, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times, back from Sundance. Hiya, John. How are you?
I am barely functioning, but I am back in town.
Sound a little raspy there, John.
A lot of long days, but certainly a lot of good movies up there. And I think probably more deals than I can remember in any recent Sundance. I mean, more than 24 deals for movies that were in the festival looking for distribution.
So I gather one of the biggest deals was My Idiot Brother, which we talked about last week, which sounded really good. Paul Rudd and kind of a goofy thing that you get from the title, but not so much.
Well, I mean, the concept of the movie is pretty straightforward. It's Paul Rudd playing a guy who in the opening scene of the movie sells pot to a uniformed police officer and is promptly arrested. He's a guy who can't really make any smart judgments or calls in his life. And then, of course, as the movie would have, he is really the voice of wisdom in the entire family. I was at the first screening. I thought it played to pretty mixed reaction. It's a likable idea, and I'm not sure how well executed it was, and I think the critics were in agreement. But Harvey Weinstein, who also bought the details for a reported $7.5 million, bought My Idiot Brother for somewhere between $6 and $7 million. So Harvey Weinstein was spending a lot of money. Fox Searchlight was spending a lot of money. I mean, it was amazing how many movies were getting sold this year.
So, John, in past years, you know, when things were really slow, you'd sometimes get these announcements, and really there wasn't that much to the deal. It was like a sort of a pseudo deal. When you really got down to it, the commitment wasn't that great. It really wasn't that much money. It was less than the movie was made for. Are these quality deals?
I think in some cases they are. I mean, one of the things that the makers of films are most worried about is the minimum guarantee. In other words, how much upfront money are you going to get? And the second thing they're really interested in is what is the P&A commitment, the print and advertising budget? In other words, how wide is this film going to be released? How many markets will it get into? And what is its potential to make some money? So I think in a number of these deals, there were multi-million dollar minimum guarantees and multi-million dollar P&A commitments. And that's not something that happens repeatedly. It might happen with one or two films, and there's probably half a dozen that had that kind of commitment coming out of this Sundance Festival.
So, John, is this a sort of a correction, or are we back? Where are we, do you think?
I guess the classic and kind of chicken answer would be time will tell. Something that buyers are always mindful of but sometimes forget is the so-called Sundance effect, that a movie can play particularly well in Park City, Utah, and not play particularly well in La Puente, California. But I will say that if you look at some of the movies that have done well this past year and even some of the Oscar nominations, reveal that Winter's Bone, The Kids Are All Right, Blue Valentine, I mean, to certain degrees, they were incredibly successful films. All three of those movies debuted at Sundance a year ago, and I have to say they were all critical and commercial successes.
Yes, so let's turn to the Oscars for a second. We've had the Oscar nominations, of course, with King's Speech, to the surprise of some, in the lead. We'll know more after the weekend. We're taping before the weekend. We're going to have SAG Awards and Directors Guild Awards, Screen Actors and Directors Guild giving out their prizes, and certainly the Screen Actors are a very influential group in Oscar balloting. But suddenly, what had looked like Social Network's race opened up again.
A couple of days before the nominations were announced, I was in Park City, Utah, and a couple of people I talked to said, it's Social Network's win. And then the nominations came out, and a lot of people are now saying it's King's Speech.
Well, when you were in Park City, I was at the Producers Guild dinner on last Saturday night, and that was when it became, you know, the winner in that group was the King's Speech, and they've been a pretty good predictor of Oscar, and yeah, that was a big uh-oh moment.
I think this is a classic question, and maybe it's an unfair comparison, but I think it's a classic question. Is the King's Speech the old-fashioned movie that's going to appeal to the older constituencies within the Academy, and is Social Network kind of the young people's movie that may not have the depth of support. I mean, I know that's kind of a glib way of looking at it, but I think in some ways it's true.
And one other factor that somebody pointed out to me that I thought was interesting was that the supporters of Social Network might be split into people who are supporters of Black Swan. That, in other words, Black Swan could siphon off votes from Social Network, whereas the King's Speech people might, you know, kind of stay unified behind the King's Speech. So it could be that, you know, in the end of the day, the way the votes are counted, the King's Speech has an advantage. Meanwhile, Harvey Weinstein, who was pushing the King's Speech, has come up with a ploy to sell more tickets. The movie got the R rating because of the presence of language in a completely non-sexual context. As anyone who has seen this film about King George VI and his effort to overcome his stammer would know. And he's talking about recutting the film.
Certainly the MPAA made a terrible mistake in giving this film an R rating. But now Harvey Weinstein is suggesting that if he cuts out some of the profanity, the film could reach a broader audience. There's two problems with that. The profanity serves a central role in the plot. There's another problem with this, which is that you cannot have two different ratings of the same film in theaters at the same time. So either the Weinstein Company will have to pull the version that's playing now or wait until after the Oscars to release the toned-down version. But I think it's also worth noting that the film in the United Kingdom was given the 12 rating, which basically is like our PG-13. And the movie is doing incredibly well there. So the British obviously have a more enlightened attitude about language. And because more people can go see it, I suspect that's part of what's driving its huge business there.
Although it is obviously England. It's about an English story. But I will point out just that there is a chance that the MPAA could give them a waiver and they could recut the movie and replace an R-rated version right away. However, I think that maybe what Harvey's getting out of this is a lot of us talking about it and stories in the press, and maybe that's the whole point.
Harvey very much does not like the fact that the conversation about the King's Speech is about this boneheaded idea. So I think in some ways he's hoping this conversation ends right now.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. The Social Network has picked up awards from a bunch of critics groups, won 4 Golden Globes, and garnered 8 Oscar nominations. And it's grossed over $200 million worldwide and counting. As you probably know by now, the movie about the founding of Facebook stars Jesse Eisenberg as Mark Zuckerberg and Andrew Garfield as his one-time friend and collaborator, Eduardo Severin.
Hey, Mark.
Eduardo.
You and Erica split up.
How did you know that?
It's on your blog.
Yeah.
Are you all right?
I need you.
I'm here for you.
No, I need the algorithm you use to rank chess players.
Are you okay?
We're ranking girls.
You mean other students?
Yeah.
You think this is such a good idea?
I need the algorithm.
All right.
I need the algorithm.
The Social Network wasn't exactly what you'd call an obvious idea for a movie, but some very major talent could see the possibilities. It was directed by David Fincher, known for those tough guy movies like Fight Club and Seven. And the screenplay was written by Aaron Sorkin, whose snappy patter entertained fans of The West Wing. The Social Network was produced by Scott Rudin, who picked up a Best Picture Award for No Country for Old Men, and who this year is behind another hit movie and Best Picture nominee, the Coen brothers' True Grit. Rudin is one of several credited producers on The Social Network. Sion Chaffin, director David Fincher's producing partner and girlfriend, is another one. There's also Michael DeLuca, former president of New Line and DreamWorks. And there's our guest today, Dana Brunetti. He started out as an assistant to actor and producer Kevin Spacey, and now they're partners in Trigger Street Productions. Brunetti has produced a handful of films that have performed respectably, but nothing like The Social Network. Though it took a group of power players to make the movie finally happen, Brunetti played a key role thanks to his relationship with author Ben Mezrich. Brunetti had optioned Mezrich's book, Bringing Down the House, which became the movie 21, which was about a group of MIT students who learned to count cards and then took Vegas for millions. Brunetti, along with DeLuca and Spacey, produced that film and thus began a fruitful collaboration with Mezrich.
So when we were about to release 21, I had asked him what his next book was, just to gear up to go and take it, you know, because when you have a movie that's doing well or you know it's going to do well, it makes it a lot easier to sell things around town. You're a little hotter.
Right.
So the strike while the iron is hot. Asked him what it was that he had in the works, and he said, "I think my next book is going to be about the start of Facebook." And initially, I was, "That's going to be a great book, but I don't know how I'm going to make a movie of it." And he's like, "No, no, just wait until you hear the story." And as he started to tell me the story, I realized, "Wow, yeah, this is an amazing tale, and this would make a fantastic film."
I mean, at first glance, it's like a guy with a computer, and how interesting is that?
Right, and that's what a lot of people's perception was initially, was like, well, is it going to be a lot of shots of typing on keyboards and computer screens and a lot of coding? And I can see how that would be the initial perception and the initial thought, and that was kind of my initial perception and thought. But, you know, it was a much deeper story than that, obviously. So he had just had the general idea. He had some contact to some of the people involved in Eduardo.
You're talking about Eduardo Saverin, who is in a lawsuit with Mark Zuckerberg, claiming that he had been a collaborator in the creation of Facebook.
Right. He was in a lawsuit.
They've settled their differences, right.
I'm sure he's doing very well.
Yeah, we don't have to have a fundraiser for Eduardo. but Mesrick was already in touch? This author was already in touch with Saverin, or you had that helped that to happen?
Ben was in touch with Eduardo but couldn't really get to him, and so we were having a screening of 21 in Boston. I invited him as my guest to that screening, and so I had Eduardo come to that and then to the after party and started just to learn, just kind of more for research for myself, to learn a little bit about the story, and started to realize, yeah, Ben is onto something here.
And, I mean, did you sit at the party and chat with Eduardo? Was he chatty?
Yeah. There was a photo of me, him, and a agent from it was actually my agent at the time at the party. And the guy took the photo and he's like, "Okay, that's so-and-so from that agency, and you're Dana Bernetti, producer. And who's this other guy?" And I'm like, "That's Eduardo Saverin, a co-founder of Facebook." And I think that was one of the first times he was actually in a photo and listed as a co-founder of Facebook in the press.
So you invite him to the party and you're hanging out with him. And are you sort of feeling like you're, I don't know, I don't want to do this in a pejorative way, but seducing him a little bit to cooperate?
Of course.
Of course.
I'm a producer, that's what I do.
How naive I feel right now, but go on.
So I left them on their own and left Boston after that screening. And then a couple weeks later, we were having the actual premiere in Las Vegas of 21. And Ben was like, I can't, I need more. And, I want to get more information. I want to, meet more people that he's with. So, what can we do? And I'm like, well, invite everybody out to Vegas. And, they'll come out for that. And he came to Vegas and he brought his friends, and that gave Ben more access to more people and more of the story. And that pretty much gave Ben what he needed to put together the 14-page proposal, which we ultimately ended up taking around town. And that's how we ended up selling it to Sony.
Now, when you were trying to bring Eduardo Saverin into the project more, and you brought him to him and his friends to this party in Vegas, I read that you trotted out Kevin Spacey to press the flesh.
That's right.
Was he not going to go to the premiere, or you just wanted to make sure they met so he could be, the movie star that met them, or what was the thinking of that?
Well, no, I knew that there was going to be a lot of celebrities at the Vegas premiere, unlike the Boston screening, and just a few that were there. It's people get a bit wide-eyed and a little bit more excited when there's celebrities around. And so I made sure that Kevin was aware of this, and that was my target for the night. And my mission for the night was to get Ben what he needed. So Kevin ended up hanging out with Eduardo, myself, and Ben. And there's actually a photo of the four of us on Facebook. You can go on the Accidental Billionaires webpage, and there's a photo of me, Kevin, Ben, and Eduardo.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with one of the producers of The Social Network, Dana Brunetti. The idea for the movie began with a 14-page book proposal written by Ben Mesrick. Previously, Brunetti had optioned another Mesrick book, which became the movie 21. And now the team that came together to produce The Social Network is planning a film based on Mesrick's next book, Sex on the Moon, about a young intern who broke into NASA's vaults to steal millions of dollars worth of moon rocks for his girlfriend. Brunetti has been known to say that Mesrick writes the kind of stories that he wants to tell, stories that the New York Times euphemistically referred to as testosterone lit.
It's not what I call it. I call it it's called dick lit.
Oh, okay. Let's not mince words. and that is your genre?
Well, It's a funny term that I came up with an agent a couple of years ago about Ben Mezrich's work. Rather than chick lit, there are books about guys doing amazing things that guys like to read, even guys that don't normally read, and can read very quickly. And it's very relatable to a lot of guys.
Right.
Hence, dick lit.
And do you think you and Ben Mezrich going forward will continue to collaborate this way?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those relationships. We don't have a piece of paper between us. We've never had an agreement between each other. I'm always just attached to his projects and get them set up, and then we do all the dirty work with the studio separately. He does his deal, I do my deal, and it's been a system that's worked well so far, so I don't have any plans to change it. I hope he doesn't.
I mean, the suggestion that I read was that he almost doesn't want to do the book unless he thinks it can be a movie that you guys would be interested in. Do a book.
I'm curious if Ben would write a book that wouldn't translate, because it does so well for him. If it is a film, I think it helps him get it set up with a publisher and get the print, a larger print of it, because there's the idea that if it comes out of the film, exactly that, it would, you know, boister the sales of the book considerably. So, I mean, I think it's smart for him to do it that way. And frankly, if the story is good enough to be made into a movie, it's usually a pretty damn good book.
Mm. So you're not going to try and find your inner female and do the chick lit version of what you're doing now. This is your thing.
I would love to.
Oh, really? I somehow felt this was a personal choice, but obviously I've overread the situation.
There are a certain type of movies that I have, you know, my war board at my office, and it's basically all my projects that are in different stages that I try to move forward every day. And the majority of those projects, if not all of them, are the types of movies that I, as a guy, would like to go see. You're not going to see Eat, Pray, Love on my war board at the office. But nothing against it. It's just that's not the kind of movie that I would go to see. And I tend to only want to make movies that I would want to see. And there's a lot of people that will make a movie just to make a movie, whether it's, you know, within their wheelhouse or not. And usually that doesn't work out so well. I gravitate to these types of movies because, like I said, they're ones that I'd want to see in a theater. So therefore, in the process, in the early stages of development or from finding them or to the production and pre-production and post and the whole marketing and promotion of it, I enjoy it because it's something I'm passionate about. And if it's a story that I like and can enjoy, I can keep that passion all the way through. And I think that's what you really have to have in order to get a movie made and made well. It's an extremely difficult task to get any movie made. And if you lose a little bit of passion, I think the movie starts to suffer.
So you never got to the point where you were like, I hate Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg, and I wish I had never heard of this damn internet.
I'm on Facebook constantly.
You are?
Facebook and Twitter constantly.
You're living the Facebook dream or nightmare. I don't know which.
I do a lot of business on Facebook. Actually, there's a funny story that Kevin Spacey is my producing partner, and George Hinkenlooper, who recently passed, but
right.
He posted on his status that I really like the idea of Kevin Spacey as Jack Abramoff. And a mutual friend of ours sent me a message and said, hey, is Kevin doing Casino Jack with George Hinkenlooper? So I called Kevin because I hadn't heard about it. I didn't know anything of it. And he's like, no. He's like, but I know this story. And he goes, I find it interesting. So I friended George, and George and I started communicating back and forth about the project. And then George got on a plane, took off to London to meet Kevin, and that's ultimately how Kevin ended up getting casted. And he finds it kind of funny and ironic that we not only did a movie about Facebook, but he got cast off of Facebook.
True. I don't know how many Facebook castings of major talent there are in the world, but this certainly
I'm sure there'll be many more, I'm sure.
Coming up after a short break, The Social Network producer Dana Brunetti talks about working with some big gorillas, Scott Rudin, David Fincher, and Aaron Sorkin. You're listening to The Business from KCRW and KCRW.com. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Today we're talking with producer Dana Brunetti, whose latest film, The Social Network, just got 8 Oscar nominations. 13 years ago, Brunetti was actor Kevin Spacey's assistant. Now he's his producing partner. And Brunetti is one of the producers who will, should The Social Network win Best Picture at the Oscars, get to go on stage to accept the award, along with fellow producers Scott Rudin, Michael De Luca, and Sion Chaffin. Among its many nominations, the film is up for Best Adapted Screenplay, which is unusual in that Aaron Sorkin actually wrote the script based on a 14-page book proposal. In fact, author Ben Mezrich was writing The Accidental Billionaires about the founding of Facebook at the same time that Sorkin was working on the screenplay for the movie.
So Ben and Aaron, they shared research as both were simultaneously writing.
Did they? I mean, I just would love to know. Obviously, you're not Aaron or Ben, but whether Aaron ever said to him, let's go with the twins version because that's a better story for the movie.
No, I don't know. There was no collaboration in that regard. We kind of knew what the story was, you know, just on the basis of it. And the most that they did, I think, was sharing notes. And then it was kind of amazing to see how quickly we got the screenplay when the book was. You know, I just read the book, The First Galley. Like, I can't remember the date, but it seems like it was only a few weeks before actually getting the first draft of the screenplay.
Let me just ask you a little bit about the getting of both Aaron Sorkin and Sony to do this project. I mean, Aaron Sorkin, in very early, without a book to even look at, how do you wrangle that?
Well, he had read the 14-page proposal and knew, as he says, by page 4 that he wanted to do it. What had happened is Scott Rudin had been he'd been aware of the project from the proposal as well, unaware that Mike De Luca and I had already set it up at Sony. He got it to Aaron and found out that Aaron was interested and came to Sony with Aaron, said, "Yeah, I have Aaron Sorkin for this project."
And by the way, I'm Scott Rudin.
Yeah, that helps.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, you imagine me. Here I am. You know, I'm a pretty young producer in this business, and I got an 800-pound gorilla on each side of me, and Mike De Luca and Scott Rudin. So it was a bit intimidating at times.
I would think so. What happens? Do you go to Mike and say, "Look, we've got Scott Rudin swooping down on our baby," and would we just throw the baby at Scott Rudin and hope that we all do well?
No. The studio, they contacted me and said, you know, Scott has Aaron Sorkin, who wants to write this, which we thought was amazing. And so they were able to work out a deal for all of us to do the project together. And who am I to say no to Scott Rudin and Aaron Sorkin? And, you know, then the same kind of thing happened once we had the screenplay, and then Fincher's name came up, and it was just like I was hitting a lottery everywhere I turned.
Yes, I suppose, although it's sort of like the ultimate good news, bad news, right? Because it's like the great news is you have Aaron Sorkin and the bad news is you have this incredibly accomplished, controlling 800-pound gorilla producer now in the mix with you.
That's true, but I think the job of a good producer is to identify where your strengths and weaknesses are and different people, how they can benefit to you and when to stand out of different people's way. And that's pretty much what I did once everything started coming together. I was like, you know, the only thing I could do is mess something up. So let me just kind of observe and have this be like the best film school I could ever go to. And the same thing was the case when I was on set. I wouldn't dare tell Fincher, you know, how to do something or how to change something. But it was like the most amazing masterclass to sit there and observe somebody like him at work. Was I couldn't wait to go every day. I was so excited. I was like a kid in a candy store running the set every day.
Now, and Sony was immediately, you know, once it was Rudin with Aaron Sorkin, they were like, here's the money. Because that's not, I mean, the reason I ask, I'm not meaning to be flip about it, but, you know, funding a movie like this would normally be, I look at what they went through on The Fighter. I mean, I don't even know if you followed that backstory of The Fighter, but, you know, they couldn't get Paramount to do anything once the thing had been developed. And meanwhile, you guys, I mean, Sony may be certainly in the minority of studios that would even consider a project like this.
Yeah, I think Sony is one of the few places that would make this project, and I give them total credit for, you know, taking a chance and rolling the dice. And, you know, it's really a drama, and they didn't stand in the way at all. And we only had one draft of Sorkin's script. It came in at 162 pages or 164 pages. They initially thought about, you know, trimming a little bit of it. To Fincher's credit, he said, hold on, just wait. And he went with Sorkin and said, read. And had Sorkin start reading. And And he had a stopwatch on his iPhone, and he timed all the scenes, and he put it all together, and it came in just at 2 hours. And so Fincher went back to the studio and said, look, I don't want to cut anything. And he's like, I think we can do this. And the only thing we changed, like, a little bit of dialogue on one of the pages. So the second draft of the script I had was still just as long. I think it might even been a page longer. And that's what we shot.
Wow, that's a great story. Now, had you even been thinking of a writer when Scott Rudin showed up with Aaron Sorkin, or were you just still in the
It was very early. So, no, I mean, we were just starting to circle different ideas for writers as soon as, you know, we had gotten it set up. But it literally was like a week later after we had set it up that Scott came with Aaron. So it was, you know, he was pretty much the only one. I never, put it this way, I never had a meeting with a writer or talked to any writer about it.
Now, going back into the Eduardo Saverin, did he get involved at all with the writing of the book?
No. Eduardo basically, he stopped talking to Ben and I early in the process, but
do you have an idea why?
I would assume it's because he probably is not allowed to after he settled.
Oh, right.
I can only assume that that's why, because we didn't get any details. When the 14-page proposal leaked, he started to, you know, he didn't speak to us as freely as he had, because I guess he realized that we were, you know, this thing was moving forward. But we had enough contact with other people and enough resources to basically get the story that we needed.
So at what point does Mark Zuckerberg, the central character of your film, I guess, does he get wind of this, and when do you hear from him?
I never did. Scott Rudin was having conversations with them, and you know, we thought that we might be able to get their cooperation, but that never came to fruition. So, I mean, they're not – from what I've heard, you know, look, I haven't had any conversations with him, so I can only – it's, you know, what I'm hearing secondhand. I know that he closed the Facebook offices and took the staff on the opening day of the film. And I think after he saw it, he wasn't as opposed to the film as he might have initially been. I think he thought we might paint a worse picture of him. But I think he's inspired by the fact, or likes the fact that the film's actually inspiring to some people. And he's heard that from some of them after they've seen the film, and that he's like an inspiration to them to be an entrepreneur or chase after a vision that they might have. So I think
screw
he
all
actually
their friends. That's very inspiring.
Well, hopefully that's not the case. Okay. Here, look, here's the one thing I will say on that. A lot of people say that Mark is a bad guy and they screwed over his friends. But one thing, I think he comes off in the film as a badass. And while you may not agree with everything that he did or how he went about it, you do have to respect and appreciate the fact that if he had not done what he did, Facebook, that 500 plus million people utilize every day, would not be what it is today.
Well, maybe. We don't really know, right?
I think we know.
Dana Brunetti is a producer of The Social Network. He joined us from New York. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. The executive producer is Matt Holzman. To leave a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness, where you can also stream and podcast the show and check out past episodes. And we're on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/kcrwthebusiness and like us. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.